We're holding on page Tesvov in Baba Kama, Ois Mem. We learned a few days ago that if a person has harmed somebody else, he has to not only pay him the appropriate payments, but he also has to ask him mechila. We said the Mishnah had said, and the Gemara expanded on it, that we learn from the story in this week's parasha when Abimelech kidnapped Sarah, and Hashem tells him, Hoshev Eish Ha'ish, V'yispal Badcha, return her and make sure that he davens for you, because you have to ask him mechila, and we got into that whole point. So now the Gemara says something that we have, by the way, also that we learn out from that story. The klala of even a simple person should not be something light in your eyes. Take it seriously, and in other words, do whatever can be done in order to counteract it. Because we see that Abimelech cursed Sarah. Now, Abimelech is a king, but relative to Avraham and Sarah, he can be considered a hedyot. He's just a commoner in terms of how important he is to the world. So he cursed Sarah, Veniskayim Bizarra, and the curse that he said came true with her children. Marsha points out that actually the drosha that the Gemara is going to say is more on her children in the first place. So there's actually a different girsa. The Gemara brings a variant of this memra in Masechet Megillah, and there it says that he cursed Sarah's descendants, and it came true with them, which fits better with what he actually said over here. Anyway, Shenema, he says to her, Hine hu loch sus einayim. He says, behold, it will be for you a covering of eyes. Now, Rashi in yesterday's Chumash goes in Barichos about what he means by that. One meaning is, in other words, like this, people will realize that I wronged you, and now having to compensate you a huge amount of money, and therefore it'll cover up the humiliation you had to suffer, and so forth. It actually goes through several explanations, but here the Gemara's understanding that he's saying, Hine hu loch sus einayim, it was a covering of eyes that you did to me. You misled me by telling me that Avraham is your brother and that you're his sister. And he says, Omalah, he says to her, Hoyo v'kisis mimeni, because you concealed that from me, v'legilishu ishech, and you didn't tell me that Avraham is your husband, v'garamt li elai hatsarazeh, and you caused me all this trouble that we learned before of what Abimelech and his family went through with everything, with all the orifices in their body being blocked up. So he says, may it be Hashem's will, says Abimelech, that you should have children whose eyes are dim. The way that you pulled the wool over my eyes, the same way you should also have children who can't see. And sure enough, it came true with her children. When Yitzchok got old, then his eyes were dim and he couldn't see. Now, there are many, many different reasons why that happened. Rashi on Chumash alone brings three reasons for it, and then the Medrash brings a whole bunch more. But one of the contributing factors was the fact that this Hedyot Abimelech said such a thing to Sarah. So we see that even the Kilas Hedyot should be taken seriously. Ion Yaakov points out the Gemara in Megillah, when it brings this, also mentions that the bracha of a hedyot should never be something simple in your eyes either. The bracha of a hedyot sometimes has tremendous effects, and the Gemara gives two examples of it involving Aravna giving a bracha to David and Daryavish giving a bracha to Daniel, and both of them came true. So he points out, by them we find that the Birkas Hedyot came true with them themselves, whereas here we're saying the Kilas Hedyot comes true only in the next generation. So therefore, so in that sense, the midah tova of the bracha, the hedyot, is stronger than the midah peronus of the klala of a hedyot. Omer Rabbahu, so Rabbahu says in this connection also, la'olam yehei adam mina nudafin v'loy mina roidfin. A person should always be one of the ones who are pursued rather than the ones who pursue others. So he should be one of the, not Marashah says, doesn't mean that he should actually be pursued, but in other words, he should be on the side of the victims, on the side of the ones who are being pursued and chased, and he should try to help them out. There are various other explanations what it means to be minayun dafin. One of them meaning, in other words, that a person should be tolerant of the fact people might be roid of him, but he's not going to go and get back at them. He won't turn around and be one of the roid of him against them. And even that also includes what we learned in yesterday's Gemara about where, for example, a person is most din l'shamayim, where he goes and complains to Hashem about another person to call down punishment on him, that would also be, in a sense, being a roidah. So a person should prefer to be one of the nirdafim rather than the roidfim. We see that among the birds, there's none that are as much pursued and prey for other birds as turtle doves and doves. And those specifically are the ones that are kosher to be brought as korbanos. So we see that Hashem prefers the nirduf. There's actually a pasuk in Kehelas that says, "V'ha'elakim yivakesh es nirduf," that Hashem seeks out the pursued, and the Medrash expands on it and gives quite a number of examples. The Medrash even goes so far as to say, even if you have, what if the pursuer is a tzaddik and the pursued, the victim, is a rasha? Nevertheless, Hashem still sticks up for the nirduf just by virtue of the fact that he's a nirduf alone, then he deserves a certain degree of rahmanus from Hashem. And it gives a number of examples with it. One interesting one from Jewish history from the time of the first Beis Hamikdash. There was a king of Yehuda by the name of Amatzia. The first half of his reign, he was basically a tzaddik. The pasuk says that he didn't serve Hashem b'lev avsholem, so he was kind of doing mitzvahs anoshim melamadeh. He's doing things out of habit rather than out of conviction, but still he was an ostensibly frum yid. Later on, there was a thing, he fought against a war against Edom, and then he took the Avodah Zarah and worshipped them. Why he did that is a whole other thing that we're not going to get into right now. Anyway, shortly after that, the king of Yisrael of that time, name of Yehoyash, what happened was, Amatzia, before he had gone to war, he'd wanted to hire a whole bunch of soldiers, several tens of thousands of soldiers, 100,000, I think, soldiers from Malchus Yisrael, and a Navi came to him and told him, don't, they're Rishoyim, and Hashem is not going to be on their side. So he sent them home, and they were very angry at that, and they went and attacked various places in Eretz Yehuda. So now when Amatzia got home from this battle, then he's angry. He goes to send a message to Yoyash, you know, your soldiers just went and did that and committed terrorism in my kingdom. I want satisfaction. I want to fight a duel against you. To make a long story short, the pasuk describes that Yoyash won the duel, won the battle, and then destroyed parts of the walls of Yerushalayim, and so on and so forth. Anyway, the upshot of it was that so Yoyash, in short, soundly beat Amatzia, and Amatzia was forced to run away to another king, to another city in his kingdom. But the pasuk goes on to say that he outlived Yoyash by 15 years. So even though he had done wrong, he had worshipped Avodah Zarah, and he had gotten himself into this whole thing, but because he was a near death, the Eibush just stuck up for him, and he lived longer.
All the kings of Israel were all bad.
All but one of them, actually, it says, Vayas Harah. There's one king of Israel, Shalom ben Yavish, who lasted for a month, where it doesn't say on him, Vayas Harah. There was actually, an explanation from the Malbim that he was trying to get rid of the Egla Hazav, and that's why they assassinated him. But other than him, you have the last king of Israel. It says on him that he did hara aloy kamalchi Israel. After Hoyu Lefonav, not like the kings of Israel before him. His name was Hoshea ben Ela. The Gemara says he took away the guards who were stationed to prevent Jews from being Ola Lodego. But yeah, other than that, all the kings of Israel, yeah, were no good next day. Okay. Hagozel Eitzim Perakchi. So the topic of this parak continues to talk about dinim of gzela. And one thing that's discussed quite a bit in the parak is the dinim, under what circumstances does the gazlan acquire the thing that he stole, and therefore he doesn't have to return it itself, versus in what cases, therefore he just has to return the monetary value of it, versus in what cases does he have to return the thing itself. So in this connection, the Gemara brings Tanya Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Haresha Gozal Soshal Chitin. Suppose a person stole a saw of wheat, Tochna, and he ground it up, Losha, he kneaded it, Va'afar, and he baked it. And at this point, having done all of that, at that point, he's certainly already been koneh with Shinui. Now you have, the Gemara spends a lot of time discussing irrevocable shinuyim, where once something has changed, it's never going back to the way it was. This is obviously an example of that. It's certainly not like the original wheat anymore. Anyway, the hifush mimena chala. Now at this point, if he goes and separates chala from it, ketzad mevorech, How could he be making the bracha? Which bracha we'll talk about in a second. Ein zeh mevorech ela menoyz. You should know, such a person, after having done all that, he stole and did all that, and now he's going to say a bracha on what he stole, that would not be blessing Hashem ela menoyz. That would be blaspheming and insulting and insulting Hashem. Val Zenema, on this deposit says, Boitseya Derech Nietz Hashem. The Boitseya, which Rashi explains, is a word that means a thief. He brings a pasuk in Mishlei, called Boitseya Botza. So the thief, Derech, who blesses Nietz Hashem, is angering Hashem by doing that. Tosfos points out that the point is, even though he did all of those shinuyim, now why does it have to mention that he baked it, for example? If we Tosfos learns that we're talking about making the bracha on challah, the bracha lahafish challah, so he doesn't have to bake it in order to be chayiv that bracha. It's enough that he needed it. Why bother mentioning the point that he baked it? So the point is, even though he did the ultimate shinui to it, nevertheless, you can't say that he's changed it enough that now there shouldn't be any objection to making a bracha. No, it would still be minoritz.
Belongs to him. He made a kinyan in
there. He made a kinyan because through the shinui, but nevertheless, it's still minoritz. It's still blaspheming and insulting Hashem to make a bracha on such a thing. Marshall points out that a different explanation. The word Beitseya, here Rashi is saying that Beitseya means a thief. Marshall points out the word Beitseya can also mean cutting, like cutting bread. So here he's cutting off a piece of the dough to take challah, and then he's making the bracha. And Marshall says the bracha we may be talking about over here is not the bracha lahafish challah either. It may be the bracha hamotzi. And we're saying that he's not mevorech ela menoyz. The previous pasuk in Tilim, it's in Capital Yod of Tilim, the Gavas Rosha Yid Lak Oni. It talks about how the Rosha pursues after the Oni and robs him. So we see that we're talking about a thief. Now, according to Tosfos, we're talking about the bracha on the mitzvah of taking challah. According to Marasha, we may be talking about the bracha hamotzi. Right. Obviously, we mean that he put together more. No, he put it together enough to be a shiur challah. Now. So when it comes to lahafish challah, then we're saying that would be a mitzvah bar b'aveira basically. Now when it comes to the question is what about the bracha on food? The Rambam brings in this connection that a person eats a dover ha'aser, he shouldn't be making a bracha on it because the same kind of thing that he's insulting Hashem by making a bracha on something that's aser. The Ravid disagrees with that and says that would be very wrong. What are you going to see? He did something bad and now you want him to do something worse by not at least thanking Hashem for the food. At least you should be doing that. In Shulchan Aruch it brings because of the suffix, and therefore as usual suffix brachas lahakol. So if a person is eating a dover aser that he taka wouldn't make a bracha on it, unless of course he's eating it because of pekuach nefesh. On the other hand, a case like this that we're talking about, not necessarily would that be the case, because again the fact is he was koine it. So you could say it's one thing to make a birkas and mitzvah on it, where the mitzvah is a mitzvah bar b'aveira, but to say a birkas and nenin on it, where after all he was coined in the thing, then that might that's not necessarily an issue.
You see, even if it was koineh,
what?
Here.
No, but that's the thing. Which bracha are we talking about over here? When you said Ketzer Mevorech, Tosfos is understanding we're talking about the Birkas HaMitzvos, the bracha on Mahafesh Challah, not the bracha on Motzi. Marashah says we may be talking about Motzi and maybe we should understand Boitseya to mean cutting the bread and making the bracha. For Maisa you have if the thing itself is a dvar isur, then because of the suffix, because of the smachloikus of the Rambam and the Ravid, then you don't make a bracha on it. But if it's something where it itself is not a dvar isur, it's just something that in this case where he stole it. So here we actually have the Beis Yosef says that in this case where he stole and made it, so even though he was coining it with shinui, he wouldn't make a bracha. Here the Magen Avraham argues with it and says that you would make a bracha on it, or at least you would say Birkas HaMazon, because that's Daraisa. So there is discussion about this point of what would happen in that case. Further on, the Gemara talks about Tana Rabbanan, Hagazlonin, a person who stole, Umalve the Ribis, or people who lent at Ribis, Shehziru, if they want to return what they stole or what they took illegally, Ein Mekablan Mehem, we should not accept it from them with certain conditions that we'll talk about in a minute. And if somebody does accept it from them, the Chachamim are not pleased with him. This was actually in yesterday's Shloshim Parakim of Rambam. The Chachamim are not pleased with such a person. Actually, the expression Ein Ruach Chachamim Noi Chahemenu, we know, of course, that's a common expression in a number of places in Shas. In other places, Rashi translates that the Chachamim are not pleased with him. Here, actually, Rashi explains Ein Ruach Chachamim Noi Chahemenu Noi Chameloshin Noch Meloshin, that there's no Ruach of Chochma and Chassidus resting in a person who does that. Because, in other words, the point is that it's going to discourage the person if you're going to accept from him what he's offering, then he or other people like him in the future might be discouraged from doing tshuva, as in the story that the Gemara is going to tell me. So Amar Rabbi Yechon Bimei Rebbe Nishnis Mishnezu. This Mishnah, this Braisa that we just said that you shouldn't accept from the Gazlan or from the Malva Beribis, this was taught in the times of Rebbe based on a story that happened. It happened once. There was a certain person who all his life he had been stealing or whatever, and now he wanted to do tshuva and return everything to the people he had stolen from. So Omrul Ishtoi, but his wife says to him, Reka, you empty person, meaning you silly person, Imata Oisa Tshuva, if you do tshuva and return everything that you took, Akila Avne Tenishokha, even your own belt won't be yours because pretty much everything that you own comes from stolen goods. The Nimna, so sure enough, he held back, well, Elsa Tshuva, and he didn't do Tshuva, and he figured if I in that case he figured then it's not worth it to even try, basically. So at that time the Chachamim said, well then let's avoid that kind of thing in the future. You shouldn't accept it from them. Tell them I'm moichu you, so as to make it easier for them to do tshuva. And if somebody does accept from them, the Chachamim are not pleased with him, or the explanation that Rashi says over here that he himself does not have a ruach of the Chachamim resting within him. So why'd she mention his belt, Davka? Marsha points out that they often had a money belt that they would keep their money in. So now she's saying over here that you're going to be a reka, even if you empty out that money belt completely and return everything that's in it, the belt itself isn't yours either, because you stole that also. So you're going to be left with nothing. Now, with that said, though, there are a number of places, including in this sugya, where it does discuss that a person wants to return, where a person is returning something, you do accept it from him. So the Mefarshim and ultimately the Poskim talk about there are a few conditions in this. First of all, it has to be that he's returning it voluntarily, not that you sued him in Beiskin. It also has to be that he's been doing it habitually, so therefore, like the person in the story, like pretty much everything he owns comes from that. And it also has to be that the thing itself is not still Be'ain. If the thing itself that he stole is still Be'ain, is still present, then he has to return that thing. Here we're talking about with certain exceptions as well. The Gemara mentions, for example, if he stole a beam, he doesn't have to tear down the whole house to return the beam. That's a special thing called Takonas Morish, that the Chachamim allow him then to return the value of it rather than tearing down the house. But ordinarily, if the thing itself still exists, then he has to return that itself, and then we don't apply this rule. There's actually a note from the Rebbe in that regard. The reason, a reason for it, besides, first of all, the thing itself, so he wasn't really koine it, therefore, but there's also the fact when he has an actual object that he stole, if he keeps it around, even if he's going to repay the other guy the money, or even if he's going to be moichel, even if the other guy rather is going to be moichel to him, it makes a certain mentality by him, you know what, theft is not so bad after all. Every time he sees this thing and he knows he stole it, then it's going to start developing a mentality by him, you know what, maybe it wasn't so bad after all. So therefore, let him return it, and it's out of his sight, and then let him realize, Taka, how serious stealing is. Okay. One thing, the Mishnah, again, the Mishnah had gone through various cases where a person stole something, and it was changed in various ways when he's koine, when he's not. So one thing it talked about is, let's say, for example, a person stole a coin, and then it cracked. So now it's not usable as a coin anymore. So then what do we say? When is he entitled to say? The Mishnah discusses there are cases where he has to repay him the value of it versus there are cases where you can tell him, Harei shalach lefanecha, here is your object, take it back. Doesn't matter that now it's worth less. It's still functional, or it's still the thing itself, ba'ein, and it's not considered to be a change that I was coining it with. So it mentions that. So the Gemara has a whole discussion on the subject of coins and on the subject of coins that are defaced or cracked or disqualified by the government, et cetera, et cetera. So now, in this connection, also the Gemara mentions about the coins of Yerushalayim. So the Gemara digresses to talk about what was the design of the coins of Yerushalayim. Tana Rabbanan, Ezeru Matbeya Shal Yerushalayim. What was the coinage of Yerushalayim? We're talking about the coinage of David and Shlomo. It was the coinage of when David first conquered Yerushalayim and made it his capital. He minted coins, and afterwards, when Shlomo took over, then he continued that. The design was David is Shlomo mitzad echad, Yerushalayim irakodesh mitzad acher. It said David and Shlomo on one side, and on the other hand, it said Yerushalayim ir hakodesh. I don't think they found any examples of those coins, but they have found coins from the time of the second Beis Hamikdash and from a little bit afterwards, from the times of Bar Kochba, that do in fact say on them Yerushalayim ir hakodesh or Yerushalayim hakodesh or phrases like that. Interestingly, by the way, all those coins that they found from the second Beis Hamikdash and the period even a little after that, all of them are written in Ksav Ivri, in the ancient Ksav that they used in the time of the first Beis Hamikdash. They continued to use it on coins in the time of the second Beis Hamikdash. The Rambam was once asked, but why is that? In the time of the second Beis Hamikdash, they were already using Ksav Ashuri for Sifrei Torah, and he answers, well, that's exactly the point. It was meant to be reserved at that point. Ksav Ashuri, the square letters that we write Sifrei Torah in, were meant to be used only for matters of Kedusha, so for matters of Chol, such as coins, where they're going to be, they could end up in the garbage, they could end up in the bathroom or whatever, then they would continue to use the old Ksav Ivri, which has less Kedusha. Anyway, so that was the inscription on it, David and Shlomo on one side, Yerushalayim Irak Kodesh on the other side.
So the signatures were written before God, not in the Shavashuri?
So there's a big discussion about that based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin and based on various other relevant sources. The Gemara has one opinion over there in Sanhedrin that originally the Jewish people used Ksav Ivre, and then only at the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash where they told Menashemayim to switch to Ksav Ashuri. The other opinion is they always used Ksav Ashuri, but then at some point they forgot it, and now it was restored at the time of the second Beis Hamikdash. There's a huge amount of discussion on that. There's a Truva of the Radvaz. There's a lot of ink has been spilled about it. There's even an interesting opinion that the first luchas were written in Ksav Ashuri, and then the second one, Heyos, they had already worshipped the eagle, and even though they had done Truva and all, then they're not on the high level to use Ksav Ashuri, and that the second luchas were written in Ksav Ivri. There's such an opinion. Yeah, it's quite a bit of discussion about that. There's in the back of one of the volumes of Torah Shlomo, there's a whole discussion bringing all the relevant sources on the subject. Okay, so that's the coins of Yerushalayim. And by the way, what is the coin of Avraham Avinu? Now, what makes us think that Avraham issued coins? Rash Tosfos brings from a Medrash that when Hashem tells him, "By God, Lashmecha, sheyotzalay munitin ba'olam," that he's going to have munitin in the world. We use the word munitin, yotza munitin, in a broader sense. That means somebody becomes famous. But really, the word munitin means money, means coin. It's related to the words in English like monetary and whatever. So it means that he's actually going to have a monetary coinage that's going to circulate throughout the world. So what was it? Zokin uskeinah mitzad echad, an old man and an old woman on one side, or bochur b'sula mitzad acher, and a young man and a young woman on the other side. Rashi explains the old man and woman represent Avraham and Sarah, and the young man and woman represent Yitzchak and Rivka. Maharsha says another possibility is it may mean, here we have in this week's parasha, that Avraham and Sarah both regain their usefulness. Sarah is wondering, Achri Bloisi Hoysel Edna. So therefore, so the old man and woman and the versus the young man and woman are meant to highlight that Hashem actually caused that old man and woman, Avraham and Sarah, to become look like they were young again, and therefore in token of that they had the young man and the young woman. An interesting point, actually. So now Tosfos makes the point that it doesn't mean that it had an actual picture of an old man, an old woman, and a young man and a young woman. That wouldn't be allowed because you can't make images of people. Rather, Tosfos says it means it had an inscription on one side, Zokin Uskena, and the other side, Bochur Ubsula. On the other hand, when Rashi brings this point, Rashi described by David and Shloimeh, he says it said on one side David and Shloimeh, on the other side Yerushalayim Eir HaKodesh. Rashi does not mention that when it comes to the Bochur Ubsula, to the Zok and Ruskena, etc. And there's an interesting point. The Rogachova makes a point in one of his Mechtavim, and the Rebbe makes the identical point in Hiroshima, that it may be that Rashi Taka disagrees and says when it came to the coins of Avraham and Sarah, they actually had images on them of Avraham and Sarah on one side and Yitzchak and Rivka on the other. You could add, and then the Rebbe points out as a practical thing. Listen, it's one thing if they have a coin that says on it the inscriptions Dovin and Shloimeh and Yerushalayim Eir HaKodesh, you know where it comes from. But if you have a coin that says Zokin and Uskena on one side and Bochur and Psula on the other, how is anybody supposed to know that it has to do with Avraham and Sarah? So therefore, that makes it more logical to Rashi's opinion that it had actual pictures of them. But Rebbe points out in that Rishima also, you know, I mean, so we know it says that Avraham and Yitzchak looked very much the same, and Avraham had Davin that he should look old, and therefore it says Avraham Zokin. But after all, the Rebbe points out, you know, in the image of a coin, you're not going to have white hair versus black hair versus whatever color Yitzchak had as a young man. But nevertheless, you could still have, they could depict things like wrinkles or whatever to make it clear that on one side is Avraham and Sarah, on the other side Yitzchak and Rivka. The question would be then, again, that you can't make images like that. The answer would be this is before Matan Torah, and such a thing would be allowed for the Rebbe actually discusses briefly in Rishimus, and there's a longer discussion about it among various Achronim. About is it taka also for Bnei Noach to make such images? We know, of course, they're not allowed to worship Avodah Zarah, but are they allowed to make images? The Rambam says they're not. There are other Mefarshim who say that they could, and the Rebbe points out over here, even if you say that they're not allowed to, it might be one of these things of like it's a double dirabanan, because maybe only also because of Bnei Ever, and therefore such a thing would have been allowed. Closer to our times, so now, you know, nowadays, of course, you know, they do make coins with images on them. One point is, a lot of times the images on a coin are usually a side view. There's less of an issue in that. The issue is more when you have a full face image of a person protruding from the coin, then there's more of an issue with that. A few hundred years ago, there was a Rav, Rav Elazar Rekeach, the Rav of Amsterdam. And he was a chosh of a rav, and even the goyim respected him. So at one point they minted a medal with a picture of him on it, and then based on all of this, he didn't like that. And in fact, he had them as many as possible of them destroyed. So it still exists. They didn't manage to get all of them, but it's fairly rare because of that. What Avraham meant to signify with this coinage, there's an enormous number of droshes on it. One interesting one from Aaron Levin, who was the Rav of Reisha in Poland before the war. His grandson or great grandson, I forget, is Nathan Lewin, the famous lawyer. Anyway, Rav Aaron says the point of it was that Avraham wanted to stress with this coinage of having Zok and Uskena on one side, Bochur and Besula on the other, is that the Bochur and Besula, taking like Rashi, that it means Yitzchak and Rivka, they're fully continuing in the way of the Zok and Uskena. Like he has the Makbeya, he has not like the formula of how to do it, how to transmit, that not only the first generation are going to be tzaddikim, but so will the subsequent generation of the young men and women. And again, there's a lot of other interesting droshes and vertlach on it. It represents the idea that even as they became old, they still kept with them the enthusiasm and the strength and the freshness in Yiddishkeit of their youth, and vice versa. Even when they were young, they already had the mature understanding and the settled mind of an old person, and so on and so forth. Okay. Further on, the Gemara continues to discuss this whole matter of coins. Now, one thing is, the Gemara discusses, back then you had, you could have, every new king issues coinage with his picture and his designs and whatever on it, and sometimes you would have, you could have counterfeits, and yeah, you could have a king issued a new coinage and nobody's familiar with it yet, so you'd go to your local money changer, and you'd have him check whether this is indeed a legitimate coin. You have something for sale, somebody wants to give you this coin in payment, you would take it to a money changer to see whether it's genuine and whether it's in fact a good circulating coin. I guess in a way it's similar to, you know, nowadays, if you want to buy something and you want to sell something and somebody wants to pay you with a check or something, you're going to have to go and find out first whether it's a good check or whether it's going to bounce. I guess it's vaguely similar to that. Anyway, so the Gemara has a whole discussion about that point. And then what happens if the money changer makes a mistake and says that it's a good coin and you accept it in payment and then it turns out that it's worthless. So the Gemara discusses there are certain cases where the money changer himself, therefore, is considered a mazit because he should have paid more attention. He should have known if he doesn't recognize this one, he should have said so. Versus the Gemara mentions a couple of people who lived in that time who were known to be expert money changers. Their names were Danku and Isser. And the Gemara says if they make a mistake, then they're not even responsible because they're so expert that they're like nobody greater than them. If they couldn't tell the difference, then it's basically like an So the Gemara tells in this connection a story. Reb Chiya also worked as a money changer. So Ahi Itza, the Achzia Dinra l'Reb Chiya. So there was a certain woman who came and showed a dinner to Reb Chiya. Somebody wanted to buy something from her. He was offering her this dinner coin, and she brought it to Reb Chiya to find out whether it's good. Omala, Mal Yahu. So he tells her it's a good coin. Go ahead and accept it. The next day she came back to him. The Omrele, she says, Achzise, so I did accept the coin, but then I showed it to somebody else. I wanted to spend the coin on something. The Omrele Bishahu, and they told me it's bad. I showed it to another money changer. I showed it to a storekeeper or whatever, and he told me it's no good. But like, canonically, so now I can't spend it. Now I have this worthless coin. So Reb Chiya told Rav. Rav was Reb Chiya's nephew. He was actually a double nephew of Reb Chiya because the Gemara explains in a couple of places Reb Chiya had half brothers on one side and half brothers and sisters on one side and half brothers and sisters on the other side. There was a blended family. Reb Chiya's parents had both been previously married and had children from their previous marriages, and then they were widowed or divorced and they married, and Reb Chiya was their son. So Reb Chiya is related to one side from his father and the other side from his mother, and eventually one of the boys from one side married one of the girls from the other side, which is perfectly okay. They're not at all related la halacha, and their son was Rav. So Rav comes out to be Reb Chiya's nephew from both sides. Anyway, so now Rav also would handle Reb Chiya's accounts. So Reb Chiya was saying was a money changer, so he had Rav, his nephew, handling his account books for him. Omale le Rav, so Reb Chiya tells Rav, Zil Chalfei Niyala, go exchange it for a good coin for her, and I'll keep the bad coin. What am I going to do with it? Uksay Vapinkosi, right, in my account books, Dane Asik Bish. I made a bad deal over here and I lost the dinner. Right, write it off as a loss, basically. So the Gemara asks, Maishna Danku v'Issu Diptiri. Now, why is it we said Danku and Issu, the great experts, they would be potter if they misidentified a coin and said it's good because when it's not. Mishum Galit Srichil Migmar, the reason is because there's nothing more that they have to learn, because it's one thing, again, a lesser money changer, you can say, it's your fault. What are you doing? Giving an opinion about this coin. If you don't know it, go ask a greater expert. But there's no greater expert than Danku and Isser. Well, Reb Chiya Nami Lav L'Migma Kaboy. Reb Chiya is also an expert of that caliber who doesn't need to ask anybody. So he should be potter. So why is he paying the woman a dinner? And the answer is, Reb Chiya, Lefnei Mishur HaSadin, who do'ava, because he's acting Lefnei Mishur HaSadin. You're right, Lahalocha, he could have told her that, sorry, you have to eat the loss, but he didn't want to do that. And we know that Lefnei Mishur HaSadin is an important point. Kidetani Reb Yosef, as Reb Yosef teaches a braisa based on the pasuk when Yisro is advising Moshe to set up dayanim. So he tells him, v'hoidaita lahem es aderech yelchuvo. He tells him you should inform them the way on which they should go. V'es amasa asher yasun, and the deeds that they should do. So Rabbi Yosef explains that each phrase in that pasuk is teaching us Yisro is telling Moshe, make sure that the dayanim, when they're teaching people Torah, they're not only teaching the people the bare halachas, make sure that they're teaching them also these important things of what it means to be a yid. So, v'hoidaita lahem, zeb beis chayehem. When he says, you should inform them, that refers to that you and the Dayanim have to teach them beis chayehem. Rashi explains that means Talmud Torah, teach them the importance of learning Torah. This Gemara is also in Bava Metzia. Rashi there gives a different explanation. It means teach them about the importance of having an umnus, of having a trade or a craft to be able to be able to have as a keli for parnasa. Rashi points out over there that since the pasuk already says that the beginning of the pasuk says that you're going to tell them the chukim and the Torah, so therefore we have to understand that the rest of the pasuk is not talking about the technical dinim of Torah. Therefore, it must be things that go beyond that. So Beis Chayyim means learning Torah, or it means the importance of having a keli for parnasa. It can mean both. Marsha and Bav Metzia mentions that Beis Chayyim then would mean not just to learn Torah, but set up a house, literally Beis Chayyim, the house of their life. Tell them the importance of setting up Bote Medrash to learn. As a derech, he continues, the way, what does that refer to? Zug milas chasadim. When he says the way, it means the way of milas chasadim, the way that a yid walks and the way that a yid acts and does chesed with another person. Marsha points out, it says ha derech, and that connects with what you have in this week's parasha, where Hashem says about Avraham that he teaches his children lasith zako mishvat. So therefore we see that haderech means that way of gmilas chasadim. Yelchu, when it says that they should go, that adds an extra word. That means zubikul cholim. That refers to not just any old gmilas chasadim, but bikul cholim. The Gemara explains in Bav Metzia means even, for example, the Gemara tells us elsewhere that when a person visits a sick person, if he's ben giloy, if they're born under the same mazel, then he takes 1/60 of the illness and gets it into himself. So he stands to lose out from visiting the other person. Nevertheless, we're saying the importance of going to be mevaker to be mevaker chola. Yochu, Marsha over there in Bav Metzia points out, it means that Yochu, you don't even do anything. Just being there again helps make the sick person's illness less. So Yochu refers to that. Bah zukvura, when the pasuk continues that they should go in it, that refers to kvura, that refers to helping a person who passed away to help make the levaya and bury him. The Gemara there in Bav Metzia explains even if it's beneath your dignity. Nevertheless, you still have to go and do that. And Marsha there explains why is it called bah, because it means any other chesed a person does, as we know, burying a dead person is called chesed shel emes, because you can't expect any reward back from him, so therefore it's bah, it's purely the mitzvah itself. It continues as a maaser when it says when Yisrael continues the deed zehadin, that refers to doing that, that refers to following the din, that refers to having a din Torah, and then to following the dinim of the Torah. And asher yasun, when it says that they should do zulefnim meshuras hadin, that refers to going lefnim meshuras hadin. They shouldn't just do exactly what it says. They should go asher yasun beyond that as well. That each person should be willing to go lefnim meshuras hadin. So therefore we see from that the importance of going lefnim meshuras hadin, and therefore Reb Chiya wanted to do that, and that's why he gave that coin to the woman rather than making her eat the cost. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Yadalad Cheshvin. Still talking about the various reasons, still talking about the various reasons how it is that our generation particularly is going to be Zoicha to Geula when we're on a far lower level than the previous ones. So we have, because we're the midgets on top of giants, it's because we have in a certain sense a greater Mesiras Nefesh and everything than they did in prior generations. And then you have on top of that also, this sort of relates back to the first point, that we have, there still is intact all the good that has all the goodness, all the Maisim Tovim and everything that has accumulated from all the previous generations, and therefore we have that. So it's similar to the Nana Sargabe Anak idea, but here focusing not so much that we're standing on their shoulders, but that more and more mitzvahs have been done over time, including in our own lives. So now you're going to ask, well, what about, doesn't the bad accumulate as well? No, because when a yid does a mitzvah, it's an eternal thing. As the Alter Rebbe puts it in Tanya, it's a yichud nitz, it's a nitzchi la'olam vod, something eternal forever. as opposed to evil is not a metzius, it's a hiddenness. So therefore, and especially after a person has gotten some kind of punishment which cleans it up, or after he's done tshuva, then for sure the rise, this battle, and disappears and even turns into good, because tshuva ma'avas donis nasa lekezachis, and therefore there's no reason to be concerned that the evil was accumulating, whereas the good is accumulating because that doesn't disappear. Okay. Continuing with halachas of getting dressed in the morning. Once a person is dressed, and we said he should be getting dressed under his blankets or whatever, then he should go and stand up and walk with his head a little bit inclined. He shouldn't be walking upright. We've learned this here and there. In Yaakov, that a person should not be walking with his head held high and his neck stretched out, as you actually have a pasuk in Yeshaya that criticizes the women of Yerushalayim for doing just that. Even less than 4 amos, it would be also to do that. Person does that, is ki'ilu doichik ragli ashchina. It's like he's pushing away the feet of the shchina, is how the Gemara phrases it. But maloi kalaretz kvoidei, and he's acting as though Hashem's covered is not there in the world. What does it mean? What does it mean that he's walking b'koyma skufa? The definition would be that he can't see the ground near his feet. And therefore that requires him to walk slowly so he doesn't trip. Now, on the other hand, he shouldn't be bending down his body or his head too much, because that also doesn't look good. It should be an average amount, so you can see somebody who's coming towards him without having to lift up his eyes too much. The Rambam phrases it actually that he should be walking in the street with his head a little bit down, like the way a person walks when he's thinking about his business affairs or whatever. A person doesn't walk with his chin down in his chest, but he doesn't walk with his head held high either. He holds his head a little bit downward and like he's focusing and concentrating. So that's what we're talking about. In addition, midas chasidus is that a person should not walk 4 amos with an uncovered head. Now, in those times, in the times of the Gemara, most people would often tackle walk with uncovered heads. And we find various places in the Gemara that imply that, where it says specifically about somebody that he could, for example, it says about Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, that when he was a child, his mother had him always cover his head with a yarmulke, because otherwise he has a tendency to be a ganav. And we see from that and some other relevant Gemaras, we see that people would often walk bareheaded, because it was hot. So therefore, but even so, midas chasidus is not to do that, but rather to cover your head. Nowadays, anyway, that everybody covers their head always with a yarmulke, so then you're not allowed to walk or even to sit with an uncovered head, because it's a matter of tznius. Now it's not just a matter of not showing yiras shamayim, it's also a matter of tznius, because in effect, now your head is a part of your body that's always covered, and therefore it has to remain covered, and even children should be trained to wear a yarmulke as well. In addition, there's also a point, actually, that the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, especially around here, the Goyim, usually in our countries, Goyim usually walk bareheaded, and Jews are kedoshim and are careful because fierce. So now there's an additional point: if a person goes or sits with a bare head, then he's like a Goy, then he's acting like a Goy in the same way. Now there, at least if he puts his hand on his head, it's good enough for a heker. Later on, and in Hilchos Tefillah, the Alter Rebbe discusses that's not good enough for davening. A hand is not good enough for that purpose, but it's good enough for a heker, so that at least if he doesn't have a yarmulke at the moment, that he's not sitting there like a goy and not sitting there without gilui arosh. So at least a hand helps with that. The Alter Rebbe mentions over there in Siman Tzadik Aleph, somebody else's hand would help even for davening.